Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Jennifer Ackerman. Today, I'm reading from the April edition of National Geographic Magazine. Our first article is written by Tara Conklin, titled Imagining Other Lives. For one writer, National Geographic was a childhood portal into our world's endless possibilities. It was also an inspiration for her latest book. Before he went to college, my father worked on a cargo ship that took him to the Soviet Union, Denmark, Finland, the United Kingdom, and France. As a young child, I would sit beside him on the living room couch, a photography book or a National Geographic open on our laps, looking at the images of distant places and people, and listening to him talk about his own travels. The photographs I loved best captured moments that evoked stories. A National Geographic picture of a Tibetan shepherdess, her clothes brilliantly colored against a stark backdrop. Harriet Tubman's fierce gaze in an article about the Underground Railroad. Or Dorothea Lange's iconic Migrant Mother, the face drawn, the eyes haunted. With each image, there was a suggested intimacy, a glimpse into the inner workings of someone else's unique, mysterious existence. In my memory, the photographs and my father's stories blend together. Did I see a picture of the rope bridge across the Zambezi River, or did my father tell me about the time he crossed it? Did my father once see a Japanese snow monkey, or did we look together at a photograph of this extraordinary creature, its eyes sad, lashes fringed with white ice? It was these moments and this imagining that made me a writer. I didn't realize it then, but the storytelling instinct that first took hold with a National Geographic in front of me would become my livelihood and my organizing principles. Those images made me feel part of a wider community. We are all connected, I thought then as a child. We are all searching for the same essential things, love, safety, family, joy. And everyone, everywhere, has a larger story about how to find them. 30 years after looking at that photo of Harriet Tubman, I wrote my first novel, The House Girl, which featured the Underground Railroad and became a surprise New York Times bestseller. I wrote another best-selling novel, The Last Romantics, which took inspiration from a family tragedy. And then, in the midst of COVID quarantine, I began writing a third novel called Community Board, about a young woman who retreats to her childhood home in wintry New England to recover from an unexpected loss and find her way back into life. In creating my character, Darcy, I took inspiration from those long-gone afternoons on the couch at home. I grew up in a small town in western Massachusetts where the snow was measured in feet, and we'd eat raspberries straight off the bush all summer long. It was a lovely, peaceful, picturesque place, but my father's stories had planted in me a wanderlust seed that grew quickly and strong. As I moved into adolescence, like so many of us, I began to chafe against my family and my town, which felt too constricting, too small. When the weather allowed, I would climb out my bedroom window and onto the steep roof, pushing myself up to a higher, flatter part, where I could watch the stars and ask myself, where will I go? Who will I meet? What do I want to become? I left Massachusetts as soon as I could to study, work, and travel in Costa Rica, New Zealand, Moscow, London, and throughout Europe. I loved this peripatetic life, meeting new people, working diverse jobs in different cities. But eventually, I yearned for a home and relationships I could sustain over the long haul. And so, 15 years ago, I settled with my family in Seattle, the city where my children have grown into teenagers and my writing career has flourished. When I began writing Community Board, it was 2020 and the world had changed suddenly and irrevocably. I worried, as we all worried, about our kids, our livelihoods, the safety of family far away, of elderly and other vulnerable populations. The book takes place before the pandemic, but I found myself imposing on my protagonist the same questions I was asking myself. How do we find inspiration when we're afraid and alone? How do we forge connection when we are filled with anxiety? How do we step outside ourselves to engage with a world that seems dangerous and cruel? As quarantine days stretched into weeks and then months, something unexpected began to happen in my little neighborhood in Seattle. It started small, neighbors waving sparklers across our street to celebrate a 5-year-old's birthday. But then grew. Food deliveries, check-ins, impromptu outdoor concerts, bottles of wine left on doorsteps, phone calls that stretched for hours. I noticed small acts of kindness and grace happening all around me, between friends, neighbors, and strangers. This sense of being part of a wider community reminded me of that feeling I'd had sitting on the couch at home as a child. We are all in this together. Across the street, across the city, or across the globe. This was the message I wanted to convey through Darcy's story. When I imagined Darcy's childhood home, I couldn't help but envision stacks and stacks of National Geographic magazines. And Darcy, in her self-imposed isolation during a long cold winter, decides to read them all. She reads about Viking ships and scientists off the Chilean coast, and poet Pablo Neruda, and the brilliant Quetzal bird. And within these stories, she finds the inspiration to reimagine herself and rejoin the outside world. One of the last stories she reads is about Jené, a city in Mali, where every year before the rainy season, residents come together to replaster and repair the central mosque, first built in the 1200s, with sun-baked mud bricks, knowing all the while that they'll have to do it again next year. The project is an act of renewal, a task undertaken by individuals for the good of the community. In Jené, architecture is a verb as well as a noun, reads the photo caption. So too are commune, join, adventure, love. Darcy begins to venture outside her house to overcome her grief and re-engage with the people around her. She meets a spry, elderly widow who wants to escape her assisted living residence, a dad of 3 sons who plans to build a state-of-the-art neighborhood playground, a rookie police officer who tracks down a rogue drone circling Darcy's block, and others, each weirder and more wonderful than the last. As the book progresses, she finds that overcoming her grief and rediscovering herself is a process she can't do alone. She needs connection with the people around her. Home is baked into our DNA. No matter how long we've lived elsewhere, no matter how many years have passed since we last set foot inside the house or apartment, town or city where we grew up, certain elements remain part of us. All these years later, while I no longer climb onto my roof to gaze at the stars, I still ask questions of myself and my place in the wider world. I still work to understand this seemingly universal desire to feel at home within myself and know my purpose within my community. To explore this never-ending, frustrating, and beautiful search for ourselves and our place, that is why I write. For us all, imagining the lives of others is also a way of imagining a richer, fuller life for ourselves. And that concludes the article titled Imagining Other Lives, written by Tara Conklin. Our next article is written by John Bartlett, titled Fashion's Desert Graveyard. Clothing from many of the world's favorite brands lies in discarded heaps in Chile's Atacama Desert. How it got here tells the story of modern fast fashion. The Atacama Desert in northern Chile stretches from the Pacific to the Andes across a barren expanse of red-orange rock canyons and peaks. As one of the driest deserts on Earth, It's a bucket list destination for stargazing tourists who come for some of the clearest views of the night sky. With its arid, rocky landscape so closely resembling Mars, the desert has even attracted the attention of NASA, which has tested rovers there. But the Atacama has also attained a less wondrous distinction as one of the world's fast-growing dumps of discarded clothes, thanks to the rapid mass production of inexpensive attire known as fast fashion. The phenomenon has created so much waste that the UN calls it an environmental and social emergency. The challenge is turning off that tap. The numbers tell the tale. Between 2000 and 2014, clothing production doubled and consumers began buying 60% more clothes and wearing them for half as long as they once did. Three-fifths of all clothing is estimated to end up in landfills or incinerators within a year of production. That can translate to a truckload of used clothing dumped or burned every second. Most of the facilities are in South Asia or Africa, where the nations receiving those loads cannot handle the amount. A landfill near Accra, Ghana's capital, that is said to be 60% clothes and 65 feet high, has gained international notoriety as a symbol of the crisis. The scene in northern Chile has been dubbed in one online video the Great Fashion Garbage Patch, a terrestrial variation of the better-known Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Colossal piles of discarded clothes with labels from all over the world stretch as far as the eye can see on the outskirts of Alto Josipco, a hardscrabble city of 120,000 residents. In one ravine, a pile of jeans and suit jackets, bleached by the harsh sun, rises above a mound of fake fur coats and dress shirts, some still bearing price tags. Bottles, bags, and other trash are mixed in. As images of the clothing heaps spread on the internet, many Chileans express surprise. "I was shocked to think that we were becoming the textile dump for developed countries," says Franklin Zepeda, a director of a company that focuses on circular economic practices. But the story of how the South American nation came to be a repository for the world's apparel rejects has as much to do with globalization and trade as it does with fleeting style trends. At first glance, it might seem that an isolated desert nearly 1,000 miles from Chile's population centers would be an unlikely destination for fast fashion's discards. But the country is also home to one of South America's largest duty-free ports, located in the coastal city of Iquique on the Atacama's western edge. Millions of tons of clothes arrive annually from Europe, Asia, and the Americas. Last year's tally was 46 million tons, according to Chilean customs statistics. Duty-free ports encourage economic activity as goods are imported and often re-exported without the usual taxes and fees. The duty-free port was established in 1975 to help generate jobs and improve an ailing local economy. Chile became one of the world's largest importers of used clothes, which transformed Iquique. As fast fashion exploded, so did imports. The Zona Franca, Free Zone, was a true revolution for the city's residents, says Bernardo Guerrero, a sociologist at Fundación CREER, an organization that studies Iquique's history and culture. They suddenly had access to things they could never have imagined, like their own car. Apparel began washing in and out of Iquique like waves as global fashions changed. Guerrero recalls a time in the 1990s when almost everybody in the city wore the same style of puffer jacket after large shipments of them arrived. It was a sign of what was to come. About 2,000 businesses of all types now operate in the duty-free zone. More than half are foreign. Hand-painted brand logos adorn warehouse doorways, and stacks of used cars, another major import, tower over the narrow streets. The free zone has also developed into a sorting depot for textile waste. In essence, we are just recycling the world's clothes, says Mesmet Yildiz, who arrived in Chile from his native Turkey 2 decades ago and operates a clothing import business named Delara. He brings in clothes from the United States and Europe, most of them from thrift stores such as Goodwill. Once the garments reach Akine, workers separate them into 4 categories, ranging from premium to poor quality. He then exports the best to the Dominican Republic, Panama, Asia, Africa, and even back to the U.S. for resale. Clothing that the importers don't want ends up in the hands of truck drivers who ferry it a few miles to the dump, where it goes through another cycle of sorting and resale in small shops and street markets or at La Carabidilla, a huge open-air market. There, a roaring used clothes trade continues on a half-mile-long strip of some 7,000 stalls. A recent visit turned up faded T-shirts commemorating the 2001 U.S. Open Golf Tournament, a jacket emblazoned with a logo of the Texas Police Force, and a wool hat with the badge of a California university, among a sea of other cast-offs. Clothing that doesn't sell at the market is destined for the desert, and much of it is made from synthetic materials that won't biodegrade. Scavengers salvage what goods they can. On a cool afternoon, a woman named Genesis rummaged through a pile of formal clothes, nurses' uniforms, underwear, and Crocs, taking fleeces and blankets for the cold nights and earmarking the better garments to sell where they may fetch a handful of coins. "Everything is useful to me," she said brightly, laughing, as she imagined herself in a brand new summer dress printed with strawberries. "We're lucky to have found this." As helpful as resale markets might have been in an earlier era, they've been overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the mounting discards. New efforts, large and small, are underway to deal with clothing waste, and attention to the mess in the desert may inspire additional projects. In 2018, Franklin Zepeda founded a startup that manufactures building insulation panels from textile waste. "I was motivated by the idea that there was a vast quantity of waste that could be perfectly transformed into raw materials to make new products, reducing the amount of clothes in our desert," he says. Another startup, Ecoatex, based in Santiago, makes yarn from discarded clothes. "Our mission is to eliminate textile waste from Chile," says Rosario Hevia, the owner. "It made me so angry that there wasn't a solution, so I've thrown myself into solving it." Meanwhile, in Akine, the clothing importer Delaria plans to open a recycling plant this year to make fillings for couch cushions from used clothes. These are small but crucial steps. The most promising solution, one that can handle the problem's scale, lies in the hands of the Chilean government. The World Bank forecasts 3.4 billion tons of garbage will be created every year by 2050. As it piles up, many countries are requiring manufacturers to take responsibility for their products at the end of those products' lives. Policies known as extended producer responsibility have been adopted in India, Australia, Japan, Canada, and some U.S. states. In 2016, Chile passed a version into law, calling it Extended Liability of the Producer, or LAY REP for short. The law makes producers and importers accountable for 6 categories of waste: lubricant oils, electronics, batteries, small batteries, containers and packaging, and tires. Initially, textiles were not listed. Tomas Saig, who heads the Chilean Environment Ministry's Circular Economy Office, says a team is working to add 3 more product types to the LAY REP, including textiles. "The most important thing is to turn off the tap, so to speak, so that these clothes don't keep ending up in the desert," he says. Converting Chile from a junkyard into a recycling hub would be the dream. In the meantime, must-have trends blink in and out of fashion, online sales keep churning, and mountains of forgotten clothes continue to grow amid the red sands of the Atacama Desert. And that concludes the article titled Fashion's Desert Graveyard, written by John Bartlett. Our next article is in the Journeys section of the magazine, written by Bill Newcott, titled Eye to the Sky. In Wisconsin, the world's largest refracting telescope is once more open to visitors. Inside the dome of Yerkes Observatory, tucked along the shore of Wisconsin's Geneva Lake in the town of Williams Bay, it is emphatically 1897. The still-rotating metal half-sphere is dominated by an enormous, lovingly polished refracting telescope, a 60-foot-long, 6-ton contraption with two 40-inch lenses at one end and an eyepiece at the other. The thing is almost ridiculously fanciful. If an astronomer or a visitor wants to look through that eyepiece, an operator flips an ancient switch and the dome's entire circular floor at 75 feet in diameter, one of the world's largest elevators, rises 23 feet to give the person access. Then, in a maneuver familiar to any backyard stargazer, the viewer takes hold of the massive telescope with two hands and physically shifts the impeccably balanced device toward the desired point of light. Ironically, the cost of maintaining all this low-tech equipment is dauntingly high. Today, as tour groups shuffle through Yerkes, it's easy to forget that the observatory nearly met with a wrecking ball after the University of Chicago closed it in 2018. They call Yerkes the birthplace of modern astrophysics, but when I visited the facility about 2 years ago, it looked more like a place teetering on extinction. The monumental telescope was draped in thick, clouded plastic sheeting that movie gangsters tend to use to wrap the bodies of their victims. It was a humbling state for a precision device that was once a magnet for the elite of astrophysicists and theoretical astronomers, Albert Einstein, Edwin Hubble, Gerard Cooper, and Carl Sagan among them. But even as I tried to make out the telescope above, Yerkes was being reborn thanks to a $15 million facelift inside and out, financed by a nonprofit group that took possession of the building in 2020. For the first time in more than a century, the observatory, including its 50-acre grounds, is open for public tours of its working space science facility. Over the past few years, Yerkes staff have been preparing for what they expect to be one of the busiest days the institution has ever seen, North America's total solar eclipse on April 8, 2024. Williams Bay will see 90.2% totality, and Wisconsinites who don't want to drive hundreds of miles to witness complete darkness could find no more compelling a setting for near totality than here beneath these storied domes. But the glories of Yerkes are not confined to the heavens. The building itself is a thing of beauty, festooned with elaborate Victorian-era stone carvings, Romanesque arches, and terracotta figures. The landmark observatory was created by George Ellery Hale and Charles Tyson Yerkes, two men with very different agendas. Hale, an astrophysicist, had the then revolutionary notion to establish a facility that housed both an observatory and an academic institution at which physicists and chemists applied their discoveries to new theories about astrophysics. Financier Yerkes, on the other hand, was one of Chicago's most hated businessmen. He poured money into the observatory to rehabilitate his image, but it didn't work, and he ended up moving to New York. Yerkes' face, however, is depicted on the observatory's exterior columns, albeit with a sinister smile and devilish horns. The artist had fun with that, notes Dennis Quaz, executive director of the Yerkes Future Foundation, which inherited the observatory from the university. Nobody liked Yerkes. The telescope's 500-pound lens, cast in France, ground in Massachusetts, made the instrument the biggest ever version of the handheld two-lens direct-view telescope used by Galileo in 1609. Because Yerkes was one of the first large telescopes designed for photography, its tube needed to rotate with absolute precision to follow star tracks, a feat accomplished by a team of men who turned the gargantuan device one click at a time, even after reflector telescopes, which use mirrors to collect and focus light, became the favored tool for space studies. Yerkes' staff continued to publish influential papers. Its archives hold thousands of research works, including Hubble's original 1920 doctoral thesis. In 2018, the university began winding down its Yerkes presence. Astronomers comparing present-day star positions with where they were a century ago still reference Yerkes' 175,000 photographic plates, but the halls, once bustling with scientists, fell silent. When the call went out to support the restoration project, the influx of cash from astronomy and architecture enthusiasts across the United States, including many from the neighboring town of Lake Geneva, for nearly 200 years a playground of the Chicago rich, was overwhelming. "People have always wanted to visit here," Kwa says. That almost mystical appear persists today, whether visitors are star buffs or not. There's something about looking directly into a beam of light that has traveled millions of light years just to end up at the back of your eyeball. And that concludes the article titled Eye to the Sky, written by Phil Newcott. And here are some travel tips. What to know. Yerkes is less than 2 hours' drive from Chicago and Milwaukee. Its guided 1.5-hour tour, Space and Spaces, is offered daily, $43 per adult. Other events include concerts and readings. Check program dates and buy tickets at yerkesobservatory.org. That's yerkesobservatory.org. Where to stay? Opened in 1968 in Lake Geneva, Grand Geneva Resort and Spa is a marvel of Frank Lloyd Wright-inspired architecture. Where to eat? Mars Resort on nearby Lake Como is a classic Wisconsin supper club. That's it for this edition of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the April edition of National Geographic Magazine. I'm Jennifer Ackerman. So long till next time.